From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Haiti since Duvalier. Journalist Amy Willens covered the overthrow of Duvalier for Time magazine. Her new book talks about those historic days and how Haiti's hope after Duvalier's fall turned to the despair of yet another dictatorship. Also today, we talked to author Cynthia Kadohata. Her first novel, The Floating World, recalls Kadohata's early days, traveling with her family across America, caught between Western and Asian cultures. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles veteran blues musician Bobby Bland, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new thriller from Martin Cruz Smith, author of the best-selling Gorky Park. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. New questions have arisen about the integrity of President Bush's choice to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Documents show that William Lucas was less than completely truthful on many important forms he was asked to sign throughout his career. More from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Lucas is opposed by most of the civil rights community because they say he's not qualified. Now, sources tell NPR Lucas omitted the critical fact that he flunked the D.C. bar exam when he applied for admission to the New York bar 8 years ago. In his 1981 New York bar application, Lucas was asked specifically if he'd ever applied for admission to any other state bar. Yes, he responded. The New York form then asked, if yes, specify the disposition made in this application or result. And Lucas, in a sworn answer, said, accepted by the state of Michigan, June 1971. He did not reveal that he had flunked the District of Columbia bar exam in 1963. The omission could cast doubt on his credibility, since there have been previous disclosures of resume inflation by Lucas. This evening, a Justice Department spokesman acknowledged that there, quote, is a problem with some of these answers. At this point, the spokesman said Lucas, quote, doesn't recall exactly where he applied and in what years. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The head of the nation's drug policy office was in Portland, Maine today, addressing a convention of the nation's district attorneys. During the speech, William Bennett offered a preview of the federal government's new drug policy, which will be unveiled before Congress in September. Ernie Freeberg of Maine Public Radio has the story.
Bennett told the DAs that the new federal drug policy will call for stricter drug laws, more jails, and more money for law enforcement. And he wants to see that same tough-minded approach extended to drug treatment programs. Bennett criticized what he called the tender-minded attitude of some treatment programs, saying convicted drug users need to be grabbed by the back of the neck.
People in treatment will tell you the treatment must be tough, it must be confrontational, it must be demanding, and in many cases must be coercive.
Bennett said drug education programs won't work if the nation's legal system can't do a better job of convicting and punishing offenders. He said the new drug policy will call for more sanctions across the board, from the third world producer to the casual user in the suburbs. But he says the first priority will be to go after addicts in the inner cities. For National Public Radio in Portland, Maine, I'm Ernie Freeberg.
The Commerce Department today reported a 23.6% jump in the nation's trade deficit in May. It was the worst trade performance this year. Imports rose to record levels, exports fell. The deterioration in the nation's trade position left the May deficit about $1 billion greater than the $9.2 billion shortfall anticipated by Wall Street. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 8 points to close the day at 2544.76. This is NPR News. Poland's new National Assembly will elect a president tomorrow for the first time. General Wojciech Jaruzelski is not certain that he will win. More from Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
The Communist Coalition has a majority in the National Assembly, but some of the deputies oppose Jaruzelski's reformist policies. They have indicated they might break party discipline and vote against the general. So Solidarity's role in the balloting has become more important. Most Solidarity deputies promised their constituents they would vote against Jaruzelski too. But if enough of the opposition's deputies were simply absent from tomorrow's balloting, Jaruzelski might find it easier to win a simple majority. Jaruzelski has promised that if he loses tomorrow's election, he will not call for a second balloting. Minister of the Interior Czesław Kiszczak would become the next logical candidate. He has even less support within the Communist Coalition because he played a major role in roundtable negotiations with Solidarity. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
The State Department said today the U.S. and Soviet Union reached agreement in principle on some key elements of a chemical weapons ban, but a treaty is not imminent. The negotiators have put together joint draft texts on procedures for destroying chemical weapons over a 10-year period once a ban is put into effect, and for surprise inspections at sites where one country suspects the other of cheating. The two sides have also made progress on exchanging data in advance of the treaty taking effect as a way to build confidence. The Energy Department said today it will decide within 2 weeks when to restart the first of three deactivated nuclear reactors in South Carolina. The reactors are the nation's only source of a gas needed to make nuclear weapons. Energy Undersecretary John Tuck said the department was in the final stages of working out details of a restart timetable with Westinghouse Savannah River, which operates the Savannah River reactors. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. When my guest, Amy Willens, went to Haiti in 1986, she planned to write about the violent and oppressive dictatorship of Jean-Claude Duvalier. But just 5 days after she arrived, Duvalier fled and Willens found herself in the midst of a popular uprising. The people's hopes turned into despair when the new government soon showed itself to be one of violence and not reform. Amy Willens stayed in Haiti for the next 2 years, and she's just written a book titled The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. Willens found a country where any attempt at political or social reform was met with a brutal murder. Many times she found herself in a storm of gunfire. She often came upon mutilated bodies in the streets. But Willens was drawn to the bravery of the people living in such adversity. Amy Willens first became intrigued by Haiti when she read Graham Greene's novel The Comedians, which was set during the days of Papa Doc Duvalier in the 60s.
It just seemed like an incredibly dark, mysterious island of corruption and evil to me when I read this book, and that started my interest. And then I started reading the Haitian exile papers, of which there were two at the time, now there are three major ones. And that seemed to sort of confirm what Green had said, but they also gave a depth to it and a sort of soap opera feeling to what was happening at that time in Haiti, which was in 1985. And that's when I began to think, well, maybe I'll go down there and just see for myself.
You were rather critical in your book of other journalists down there who stayed at hotels. I guess you seem to raise the idea of the journalist slash tourist who covers events and then goes back to the hotel. Are you critical of that kind of journalism?
Yeah, I'm very critical of it. I don't think it only happens in Haiti, and I don't think it's the fault necessarily of those particular journalists, but more of the structure of journalism where you send in a guy and then you pull him out and he doesn't really have a chance to learn anything about the country and to set things in a context for his readers. And also the awful fact that only when blood is shed really do newspapers consider these countries worthy of their attention. But I also think that you know, if you're covering a place for a long time over and over, even if you only go there because of bloodshed, you ought to learn the language. You ought to know more people than the ones who speak English. I just think that that's a sort of inexcusable thing. For someone who's sent in suddenly, I can understand it.
Does, though, someone who comes in quickly and leaves after the events are over, though, have a kind of objectivity that a journalist living there might not have?
Well, if you think that objectivity is ignorance, I suppose he does, but otherwise, I mean, I don't consider my book an objective book. It's a book by a writer, not by a journalist in many ways. But I don't believe in objectivity. I think that any news you report has a point of view, even if you don't want to acknowledge it. So, you know, I think the ignorance is worse and just an excuse.
You went to Haiti with certain kinds of expectations, and I guess part of these expectations were driven by the headlines that you'd read, and I suppose imagining that within one day you would meet every headline at every turn there. What did you find when you came there? And this was 5 days before Jean-Claude Duvalier, Baby Doc, fled the country.
Well, what I found, I talk about this a little bit in the book, what I expected was something like what Graham Greene had described in his book, darkness, evil, you know, a brooding fear over everything. And in fact, what was happening was a lot of organizing against Duvalier. And so there was more of an open feeling of incipient revolution. And that was very exciting to me, and in fact had not been in the headlines until someone in the State Department said that Duvalier had already left the country. So I went down there, and I was confronted with openness and excitement instead of brooding fear and corruption. But that only lasted a little while.
You've used the word evil twice to describe Haiti. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean a situation of repression, corruption, and exploitation on the part of the government. A situation where anyone who wants to do any good in Haiti is either exiled or silenced or assassinated. And, you know, that's what it was like down there, and I consider that evil. I consider that there is evil in other countries. I don't think of Haiti as the sort of black republic, of the nightmare republic, as Green described it. I don't think that's true, but I think there have been times in Haiti's history where that has been the case.
Covering a small island like Haiti, a small country like Haiti, what were the kinds of obstacles that you faced, and also covering a situation that was both volatile and dangerous, what kinds of survival skills did you learn as a journalist?
Well, I learned some silly sort of practical things from being in demonstrations where the police fired on us. You know, you learn what kinds of things you can hide behind and will protect you and which ones won't. Like, automobiles don't really protect you from automatic fire. So you learn little things like that that seem kind of funny in retrospect but are very practical at the moment. And on the larger scale, the obstacles to reporting in Haiti are, it's very hard to be on both sides. It's hard to be objective as a reporter in Haiti because there's so much suspicion, and if you are talking with opposition leaders and then they find out that you're hanging out with the Tonton Macoute, who are the old militia of François Duvalier, they're his secret police, the opposition leaders can get a little nervous, and, you know, there's a lot of fear of spies down in Haiti.
Were you afraid of endangering any of your sources?
I think I was very careful, but yes, I was sometimes afraid, not so much of endangering their lives, but just of giving away secrets that I shouldn't be giving away, foolishly, not even realizing it.
My guest is Amy Willens, and her book is called The Rainy Season. It's about Haiti after Duvalier, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. What happened to the revolution that got rid of Jean-Claude Duvalier in 1986? It looked as if there was a short-lived celebration after he left, but what happened to the movement that got rid of him?
Well, first of all, revolution is a very gross misnomer, I'm afraid. What happened was the people were organized, more organized than they had been in years before the fall of Duvalier. And they finally managed to get together and put so much pressure on the powers that be, the U.S. State Department, the Tonton Macoute, the army, and Duvalier himself, so much pressure that it was felt politic to get rid of Duvalier. In other words, what I think really happened, and this is obviously with a lot of hindsight, is that once Duvalier was removed, it was felt that that would lessen the intensity of the movement and that that would sort of cork back up the movement. You get rid of him and then the people will calm down, was the feeling. And that didn't really happen. What happened was that people continued to demonstrate against what they felt was Duvalierism without Duvalier, and that movement was then fairly rapidly repressed by the new government that was installed.
The present-day violence that you're talking about within Haiti, you mm-hmm. seem to trace to Haiti's early beginnings. It was a slave state first ruled by the Spanish and then the French. There was a successful slave revolt that went on for 18 years that finally drove the French away. This early and difficult beginning for Haiti, how do you see that in its present-day politics, in its present-day life?
I think you have to remember that not only was it a bloody and violent and unprecedented revolution, that is, a slave revolution against the colonizer, but it was then followed by a general abandonment of Haiti as a world nation.
In other words, abandoned by the world.
Yes, because this was a slave revolution. You can imagine how the United States and France and other slaveholding countries felt about a country whose slaves had risen up against the masters. They were not too pleased. And they refused to recognize Haiti. They continued to sort of block its trade. And so it was, first of all, it was a pariah in the world's view. And then second of all, I think it was very hard for the slaves who had taken over and who had been brilliant, brilliant generals to then set about building a nation, because the nation was divided and they did not have a model that they knew of, that they had grown up with, on which to base such a state. They were slaves, and all they knew was the plantation or the older ones, the tribe back in Africa. So they didn't have that much of an idea of how to build their new nation, and I think that the country has suffered from that. But also remember, this was a very early revolution. The other Caribbean nations did not get rid of the colonizer until more recently, like 30 years ago, 20 years ago.
And this was a revolution that took place in the 19th century.
Right. 1804 was the year of independence from France.
So what kind of system then filled this political vacuum?
Well, I'm afraid that a system of sort of big rulers with a lot of men around them grew up around this, almost a tribal thing, although I hate to say tribal because I think occasionally it can be interpreted as racist. But that sort of thing happened. There were fiefdoms, there were large landholders who had a lot of power in their areas. And then there was the central government, and the central government was really a government that exploited the peasantry. But in terms of doing anything in the country, you know, building things, stuff that we expect of government, they didn't do a lot of that, and they still don't.
Is that in part because of the isolation of a new and struggling country the way Haiti was?
It's in part because of the isolation. It's in part because in order to be recognized by France, Haiti agreed to pay a huge amount of debt. And so this was a terrific problem for Haiti for almost 100 years, repaying their debt to France. Just for recognition, just for recognition. It's an incredible story. And then it's in part because Haiti was at the time, for a long time, considered important geopolitically in terms of its strategic geographical position. It guards the other side of the Windward Passage with Cuba, and that was an access route to the rest of South America at the time. So there was a lot of foreign intrigue going on in Haiti, and I think that served to destabilize governments and corrupt governments also.
I'm speaking with Amy Willens, and she's written a book about Haiti. This is Haiti Since Duvalier. The book is called The Rainy Season. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Amy Willens. How was François Duvalier, who ruled Haiti from 1957 until 1971, how was he able to consolidate his power?
I think he was one of the cleverest politicians who's ever ruled in Haiti. He came to power sort of on the crest of a proto-black power movement. And He had a lot of popular support at that time, and he very quickly realized, being an astute historian of his country, that he was going to have problems with the army, which was at the time, in 1957, U.S. trained and mulatto in color, and not very well disposed toward the black middle class.
And we should interrupt to say here that part of the power struggle in Haiti seems to be between the mulattoes and the blacks.
Yeah, there are lots of questions of color and class in Haiti, obviously. So he decided to dismantle the hierarchy of the army so that there would be no strong man who could really challenge him. In order to do this, he had to establish an armed force of equal weight. So he established the Tonton Macoute, which started as the Volunteers for National Security, I believe. Yes, I'm trying to translate from the French. And they were quickly nicknamed the Tonton Macoute, and they were an army of what is called in German social history, Untermensch, the underman, people from the slums, people who had no money and no authority. And they were like a Gestapo. And they were used by Duvalier, they were well treated by him, and if they were not paid, they were allowed complete authority in their little region of control. And therefore, they were completely loyal to him, and they would do anything.
Tonton Macoute means uncle boogeyman, which to my mind means two different things, uncle being a more affectionate term and boogeyman obviously being a scary person.
Right. Well, Macoute means actually it's a straw bag that the peasants carry around with them. And Tonton Macoute is an actual figure from Haitian nursery tales. He is the guy who comes around in the middle of the night. He's like an evil Santa Claus, and he takes bad children and puts them in his bag and takes them away forever. So he's a figure that you would use with your child. If your child was bad, you would say, Tonton Macoute is going to come and take you away. And that was obviously adopted by the people, I believe, not by Duvalier.
So the Tonton Macoute was used against the army.
It was used against the army as a parallel structure that would protect the president. And one major figure in the army was assassinated under Duvalier. The military academy was closed. That was the training ground for the officers. So he effectively destroyed the most powerful men in the army and then had the Tonton Macoute to ensure that they would not be able to lead a coup d'etat.
One of the people that you interview says that in order to understand Haiti, you need to understand voodoo, and that Haiti is a religious state like Iran and other countries around the world. How much do you understand voodoo?
I think I understand it very little. I mean, you just feel watching it, and I've watched a lot of ceremonies, and I've seen how people behave because of their belief in voodoo. But watching it, you feel that unless you could manage to believe it in some way, that you'll never really understand it. And I remain a skeptic about all religions, so I don't feel I really understand any true believer.
Then do you not understand Haiti?
Well, maybe I don't, and I think that's something that that perhaps gives my book a little extra authority, is the admission of the lack of understanding. I think a lot of foreigners have written about Haiti as though they understand everything. You have to remember that you're an outsider, and you will remain an outsider no matter how much you love the country and want to be one with the people. But you do learn, you observe it as a foreigner and in an intellectual way, and you learn about voodoo structures, which are very authoritarian and rigid and clearly delineated. You learn about just how deeply the people can believe in this and how that can control their lives. A lot of foreigners who've gone to Haiti come back saying, oh, voodoo is so beautiful, it's such a wonderful thing. I'm not someone who necessarily believes that.
Well, what do people who believe in voodoo then believe in?
They believe in a universe that is constantly overseen by the gods, in which, it sounds like any religion, in which any act of yours is noticed and taken into account in whatever will happen to you next, so that anything that happens to you is perceived as full of meaning. If you trip, that means something. If your child becomes ill, that means something, and it's because of something you did or failed to do. It's like any other religion, but it seems more so somehow because it's peasants who believe it. I just think it's extremely rigid in its belief in that everything is predetermined.
Haiti is an exceedingly poor country. How has the poverty affected life there, since it seems to permeate everything?
Well, I'm of the opinion that the poverty is the most important thing in the current political crisis in Haiti, and perhaps in the old political crises also. The poverty is so severe there that since I went to Haiti, I've been to other third world countries, and they all seem blissfully happy, sort of fat and content. Burma was one of them. What happens in a country where you have such terrible, inescapable poverty is that any amount of money can corrupt almost anyone. Obviously, there are great and brave exceptions. And so you end up with people who should be on one side, just by the conditions of their lives, working against themselves for a couple of dollars and a bottle of rum. And it's a very, very bad situation for organizing.
You say that 1.5 years after Jean-Claude Duvalier left Haiti, that it's harder to be on the streets. People are hungrier. People are angrier. What does that say to you about the future of Haiti?
Well, that was 1.5 years after Duvalier fell. This is now 1.5 years later, so the situation is a little different. What it says to me about the future of Haiti is that the possibilities for organizing against corruption and oppression are so limited, and it's so difficult to do, that it's going to take a very long time before real change, as opposed to this ostensible revolution that overthrew Duvalier, is going to come to Haiti, and that it has to be done, organizing has to be done quietly and outside of Port-au-Prince and with peasants and very slowly with a new bunch of people who have had their consciousness raised. Maybe some kind of change can come, but that it's not going to happen in this kind of spurt of excitement supported by the United States and the Haitian army. That kind of thing is never going to be a real change in Haiti.
Have there been any changes since Duvalier?
Yes, I think the major change is the freedom that the press has had in the past 3 years. But even that is now being curtailed. Radio Soleil, which is the Catholic Church's radio station, has just been, as they say in Creole, swept out. The church fired 7 of its most well-reputed journalists, and now it's just broadcasting music, I think, if it's even broadcasting at all.
Where will the leaders of what will come next, where will they come from?
Well, people who hope the best for Haiti say that they hope that a leader will arise from the peasantry in the next 10 years, 15 years. And I think, you know, if such a leader could emerge, that would be the greatest thing for Haiti. Her original leaders were such men. And Haiti needs someone who understands the peasantry and doesn't just want to live on their backs, you know, like a monkey. So that could be a place where a leader will come from. And there's a lot of organizing going on in the countryside to stop the exploitation of the peasant and to make him aware that he can refuse his labor in exchange for putting pressure on the big landholders. There's a lot going on, but it's more low level. It's not the kind of thing that would inspire newspapers to send journalists down to Haiti.
Why is your book called The Rainy Season?
Well, it sort of came to me in a vision one day when I was standing on a little terrace and the rain started coming down, and I saw just everything being swept away down the hill, all the rain, and a little boy riding down the rain in a banana leaf. And, you know, it just seemed to me such a great image. Here's this incredible rainstorm. It's taking away all of Haiti's topsoil, of which there's hardly any left anyway, and sweeping it into the sea. And yet it's so hot out, and everybody's so glad for the rain. You know, it just seemed to embody for me all the different problems in one meteorological image.
Well, Amy Willens, thank you for talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot, Marnie.
Amy Willens' book, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Dr. Michael Bodden. For 25 years, he was a medical examiner for the city of New York. As a forensic pathologist, he's an expert at investigating unnatural death. Bodden was the chairman of the forensic panel that reviewed the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, Jr. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. The Floating World is Cynthia Katohata's first novel. It's about the floating world of childhood memories of travel, prejudice, and the American dream, and growing up in two very different cultures. Coming up, we talk with Cynthia Katohata. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Bobby Bland. He started out as B.B. King's valet. He's since become an established figure in the blues scene. And book critic John Leonard reviews Polar Star. It's the sequel to Martin Cruz Smith's bestseller, Gorky Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. William Lucas, President Bush's controversial nominee to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, has apparently omitted key information from a sworn application. Sources tell NPR that Lucas omitted the fact that he flunked the D.C. bar exam from his application for admission to the New York bar in 1981. Other questions are also being raised about Lucas's credentials. The information comes on the eve of Lucas's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. More than 100 members of the House have asked President Bush not to meet with a prominent South African politician unless the country, among other things, lifts the state of emergency. There are reports that President Bush is scheduled to meet next month with F.W. de Klerk, the leader of South Africa's National Party. The South African government gave black leader Nelson Mandela permission to have his family with him at his prison house today as he celebrated his 71st birthday. NPR's John Madison reports.
It was a wet and cold Victor Verster prison that greeted Mandela's wife Winnie and Mandela's children and grandchildren from his two marriages. They arrived in five cars and were immediately surrounded by reporters and supporters. The family spent 5.5 hours with Mandela. Mandela's wife and his lawyer say they do not expect him to be released soon, but the speculation continues to grow as he receives more and more special visitors. Besides President Botha, he's reported to have seen several other cabinet members. And last Friday, six men who were sentenced to life imprisonment with him in 1964 were brought from another jail to spend a few hours with him. Mandela recently completed work for a second law degree, and the Correspondence University, where he studied, has applied for permission to hold a graduation ceremony at his prison cottage. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
More than 70 members of Congress are calling on the Bush administration to cut off all U.S. non-military aid to the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a letter to Secretary of State James Baker, the congressmen say the Contras have continued to launch offensive military operations inside Nicaragua, and they say these attacks violate the bipartisan agreement between the president and Congress. The Contras are also accused of attacking civilians. The agreement calls for a cutoff of non-military aid if the Contras continue offensive operations. The letter comes as the Bush administration is reducing funds available to the Contras for their political activities here in the United States. The immediate impact of this reduction will likely be the closing down of the Contras office in Miami, which the administration says is a way to encourage the Contras to return to Nicaragua to participate in the election scheduled for February. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down today 8.73 points to 2544.76. Declines led advances 8-5 in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Bobby Blue Bland is a blues singer who's had a relatively successful career. If you figure in all the ups and downs a blues singer has to endure, from a manager who had him under tight control to living through disco. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has this profile.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, and I heard my baby groan, and I felt so brokenhearted. She used to be my very own.
There's always been a misconception among most rock and roll fans that blues faded away with the coming of doo-wop and soul music in the late 50s, and that only white musicians and audiences kept the careers of blues musicians alive. There are many performers whose stories would refute this, but only one of them has had the long-lasting, wide-ranging success of Bobby Blue Bland. Bobby Bland was born in rural Tennessee and went to Memphis in the early 50s to join a group called the Beale Streeters, who included B.B. King, Willie Nix, Johnny Ace, and others. In classic blues fashion, he worked as B.B. King's valet and recorded as his vocalist occasionally. In 1955, Don Roby, a black businessman from Houston who owned nightclubs and record labels, came to Memphis and signed Johnny Ace from the Beale Streeters, picking up Bland and Junior Parker, another Beale Streeter, along the way. Ace was hugely successful, but after his death, which is another story, Roby had a brilliant idea. He took Ace's band and put Parker and Bland in front of it. Whoever sold the most records and got the most applause on the Blues Consolidated tour that followed this decision would wind up with the band. It was a close call, but Bobby won, which was a lucky break for him, because hidden away in the band's trumpet section was one of the greatest arrangers in rhythm and blues, Joe Scott.
Further on up the road, someone's gonna hurt you like you hurt me. Further on up the road, someone's gonna hurt you like you hurt me.
Scott was a wild man, absolutely in touch with the times, which is how Farther On Up the Road wound up in the top 10 in 1957, despite the fact that it was a blues tune. And having such a great band behind him pushed Bobby Bland harder and harder, and his singing got more and more emotive.
I said, I pity the fool. Well, I pity the fool, yeah. I said,
Bland's secret weapon was a rasping growl that sounded like he was strangling with rage or sorrow. It had a magnetic effect on women, as I saw one night. Before Bland went on, his valet asked him if there was anything he could do for him. Yeah, said Bland, go out there and keep them bears off of me. Bears are beauties. They kept buying his records. He even recorded songs that had been done so many times that you'd think nobody would ever want to hear them again, and he made them work.
They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. They call it Stormy Monday.
Even Stormy Monday was a top 10 rhythm and blues hit in 1962. Through the heyday of Motown, he kept having hits. 18 chart records between 1963 and 1968, and nearly every one was a masterpiece.
I said it wasn't long ago I was doing real good. Don't you know my baby was acting like a sweet girl should? But she found another. Well, Lord, and I got the news, and now I'm here suffering from a touch of the blues.
It wasn't until the mid-70s, after Don Robey's death, the birth of disco, and his record labels being bought by another unstable company, that Bobby Bland finally left the charts. But this isn't a story with a convenient end. Bland continues to record for MCA, and sometimes he does a good job. But he also tours quite a bit, and his shows are as good as ever, even if Joe Scott is no longer with us. Bobby Bland is as popular in the South as he ever was. And the last time I saw him, there was a 17-year-old screaming her head off right in front of him.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Turn on the light, let it shine on me. Turn on your love light, let it shine on me. Let it shine, 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 let it shine.
This is Fresh Air. Cynthia Kadohata's first novel, The Floating World, is the story of a Japanese-American family traveling through the country in the 1950s looking for work. The story is told through the eyes of the adolescent daughter, Olivia. Cynthia Kadohata, like the narrator of her novel, is a second-generation Japanese-American who also experienced a rootless childhood. I asked her if, while growing up, she ever felt any pull between her Japanese past and her uncertain American present.
No, I wouldn't say I felt I was caught between the two, but I did feel sometimes I didn't quite belong here. I mean, I still feel that at moments, but I definitely feel more American. I've never been to Japan.
Did you feel your parents' conflicts at all? I suppose it was their parents that came to this country. Did you feel that they were at all in some kind of conflict about being here?
I know that one of my parents felt that, well, my mother has said that she'd rather be white. My sister, if she's going to be in America, she'd rather be white. My sister has said that she'd rather be white just because I think they felt that it would have been easier for them.
Your father was interned during World War II.
Uh-huh.
Why did they keep that a secret from you?
I don't know if they kept it a secret or if they just never told me, which is keeping it a secret. I'm not really sure, but when I ask him about it today, he's very kind of laid back about it. Or I'll ask my aunt, and she'll say, well, no, it was like a camp. You know, you're only 15 or you're only a teenager, so it doesn't really matter. But he kind of acted like it was no big deal. And it wasn't until I got into college that I asked him a little more about his life, and he was still very reticent.
And knowing your father the way you do, was it a big deal?
Yeah, I think it changed his life. I think it was horrible. I think it was horrible for him, but it's hard when something like that happens to sort of regret it because you had just had no control over it. I think he, you know, would feel that if he admitted it, that would be a sort of how hard it was, that might be a sort of defeat for him. I'm not sure. I actually was talking to someone the other day whose father was in a Nazi concentration camp, which, of course, was much more horrible. And he said his father was very matter-of-fact when he talked about it, and I'm not really sure why.
Your father really traveled, I guess this was during the 50s, looking for work after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it hard for him to find permanent work?
I'm sure there was some prejudice, but also he wasn't sure what he wanted to do. He had just gotten out of camp, and I don't know. I'm not really sure why. We don't really talk about, I haven't asked him about that.
What kinds of jobs did he hold down?
He was mostly sexing chickens, but he also, at one point, he and my mother owned a small grocery store. And let me say, he did do body and fender work also.
Tell us about sexing chickens.
Well, it's awful work. It does go on, you know, as I say in the book, for you know, hours, 17 hours, you know, you'll have a shift for 17 hours. And it's just, you know, you separate the males from the females and then you throw the males out because they're not you know, they're not usable for laying eggs.
In your book, The Floating World, the father in this book sexes chickens, and many of the other people on the assembly line were Japanese. Was that true for your father as well? Was it the kind of work that people thought Japanese people could do?
Yeah, actually, I have heard people say, well, you know, Japanese are better at it. They have good hand-eye coordination or something, but I don't think that had anything to do with it. Today, I think it's a lot of Koreans, you know, it's just, you know, Korean immigrants. But before, yeah, it was almost all Japanese.
Your book is about a girl named Olivia. I mean, she's the kind of central character. It's really her memories, her pictures, her family that she talks about. I must ask how much of her is you and you are her, considering there seem to be a fair number of things that you two have in common.
I don't really think of her as me, but maybe in 30 years I'll look back and say that really was me. I'm not really sure. I don't think of it as autobiographical, but of course it is in some ways. But a lot of the events that happened are not true at all. So,
I'd love to have you read the opening page of your book. Mm-hmm. You have a character, a rather memorable character, your grandmother, Oba-san.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just like to have you read the first two paragraphs.
My grandmother has always been my tormentor. My mother said she'd been a young woman of spirit, but she was an old woman of fire. In her day, it had been considered scandalous for young Japanese women to smoke, but she smoked cigars. Once, when she got especially angry, she took a piece of damp cosmetic cotton and placed it on my ankle so I would hear the sizzle of cotton and think it was skin burning. Later, she cried. Of the four of us kids, I thought she liked me least. My mother said she didn't dislike me, but just expected more of me because I was the oldest. My grandmother surprised my family by dying one night in a motel in California. Neither of my three brothers liked her any more than I did, and none of us cried at the funeral. My grandmother used to box her ears whenever she pleased, and liked to predict ghastly futures for all of us. We traveled a great deal, and sometimes in the car she talked on and on, until even my mother became annoyed and told her to keep it down, just as if she were one of us kids. When she got mad, she cursed me. "May you grow hair on your nose," she would say, and I would run to check a mirror.
Was there anyone in your family like her?
No, actually, in fact, some people who have read this, a friend of mine told me that a lot of people were talking that I was an abused child, about how I was an abused child and so on, but no, nobody ever, we weren't a family who even gave spankings, so.
Where did she come from then, this fictional grandmother of yours?
I don't know, I guess that just my imagination.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was thinking that I do have a memory of my father's mother. I hardly knew her, but I know she was a little temperamental, and I think of her. I think I thought of her, and then I just built on that. But I mean, I don't mean that in any way disrespectfully towards her.
This grandmother in your story is a storyteller. I mean, she can tell stories, I suppose, like nobody else. Mm-hmm. And you're a storyteller. I mean, in part, is whoever this fictional person is that somebody you got this storytelling from?
Well, in that respect, she's probably telling the stories that I would want told to me. So it's more maybe my fantasy of what I would have wanted.
Well, both you and Olivia have had a kind of nomadic life where your fathers were looking for work. And Olivia describes traveling in the car, and she says, "We passed in and out of alertness when we traveled." Are you talking about that sort of trance state that you have when you're taking a long trip somewhere?
Yeah, that I think is very true to life. We did move around, and you did learn. Even today, I still tend to daydream a lot, so I think I learned that way back then, that was the only way to keep yourself occupied sometimes.
And does that road hum kind of add to that trance-like quality?
Yeah, I actually love it. I take Greyhound buses more frequently than I fly, so I think I learned to love it.
Well, what I was thinking of as I was reading your book was how when you are traveling in a car and you look out the window, there is a kind of frame. I mean, that the window actually frames the moving pictures as they go by.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, in a way, like going to the movies.
Yeah, it is. It was, in a way, it's probably bad. It might make you more passive because you're watching life a lot more than, but you're also living it, you know, in the confines of your car. But a lot of it is just watching, and it is like a movie.
What images do you remember?
I mainly remember, I guess, just seeing the land around me stretching out. And I remember motels a lot. I remember all those sort of, you know, pale blue swimming pools. I loved the motels, actually. They all looked the same, sort of, but I remember those. I think mostly motels and the landscape. Oh, and also diners.
In Japanese, ukiyo means floating world, mm-hmm. and it refers really to two things. One is, is a kind of district within a city, I suppose, that where the brothels and the bathhouses mm-hmm. were, I guess referring to kind of sensuality or some kind of pleasure. And it also means change or impermanence. And I'm mm-hmm. wondering what ukiyo or floating world means to you.
It means that. It means change and impermanence and just that. And just that feeling of change and impermanence. It's more of a feeling, I think. For me, it means more of a feeling than an actual place or an actual process.
Olivia, there's a sentence or the beginning of a sentence in your book where she says, I thought I remembered. And I don't remember what she thought she remembered, uh-huh. but it reminded me of that feeling when you can't remember if what you remember is the truth uh-huh. or something that you made up. Do you know what that feeling is? I mean, do you trust your memory?
No. Well, I trust my memory of my feelings, but I definitely don't trust my memory of actual events. And so in that respect, maybe it is sort of autobiographical. Like, I don't know that the events actually happened, but I know that the feelings did.
Do you travel much now?
I love to travel, and I still take Greyhound buses when I go rather than flying, mostly. But, I do, and I have moved a lot as a grown-up as well.
And you like that the movement, again, the kind of exploration that comes from taking off?
I do like it. There are times when I feel a little disturbed because I don't know quite where I belong. I have family living all over. So there are times when you know, it bothers me that I've moved so much, but there are other times when I love it and I feel that it gives me a lot of freedom and autonomy.
This is your first novel.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that there are more in the works? I mean, is the next one starting?
Yeah, it's starting. I'm not that crazy about it yet, but yeah, it's starting.
Novelist Cynthia Kodahata, her new book, The Floating World, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
What do you have for us today?
Well, we have a report from Tom Jelton about the Nicaraguan economy 10 years after the revolution. He says, not so good. Also, a report from Iris Adler about the Massachusetts economy 1 year after the election that Michael Dukakis lost for president. Also, it seems, perhaps not a Nicaraguan shape, but not so good. We talk with the author of a study of cynicism in America, a study of a survey finds that cynical attitudes are on the rise in our country, especially among younger people. And we also hear about cannibalism in America. We have no indication it's on the rise, but an investigation of a famous old event.
Well, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Arkady Renko, the Moscow police investigator readers first met in Martin Cruz Smith's novel Gorky Park, is back in a sequel, Polar Star. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
I thought the first two-thirds of Gorky Park were about as good as a murder mystery can get. Somehow, Martin Cruz Smith had written a detective story that seemed Russian down to its very bones, that sang in Russian and dreamed in Russian. Gorky Park had the feel of a brilliant translation, and yet Smith also insinuated all the exotic information an American reader would have no way of knowing, and a Russian character no reason to think about. How Moscow cops work, how that work is messed with by the KGB, mink farming, the feeding and drinking and automotive habits of a not-so-classless Soviet society, and so on. And then in the last third of the novel, Police Inspector Arkady Renko went to New York, and the book fell apart. The movie version was even worse. I stamped my foot. Arcady returns in Polar Star, and Polar Star is just about perfect. Arcady, a political unreliable, has been punished for abetting a defection to the West. He's spent time drugged in one of those fun-loving Soviet psychiatric hospitals. He's escaped to Siberia, a fugitive who flees from one dreary job to the next, until he ends up on the slime line in a huge Soviet factory ship, the Polar Star, whose task it is to process the tons of fish hauled up by American trawlers in the Bering Strait. In one of the nets submitted to this factory ship is the naked body of a young Soviet woman who seems to have slept with every male, American and Russian, within sonar range of the Arctic Circle. Because the fishing expedition is a joint Soviet-American operation, her murder has every variety of political repercussion. Because Arkady is known to the ship's captain as having been once upon a time a Moscow police detective, he's summoned from his below-decks chore of vacuuming pinkish water from the eviscerated bodies of dead mackerel to save everybody's pink face. You'd think he'd welcome any way out of the slime line, where, quote, some of the fish literally explode as their air bladders expand on the way from the bottom of the sea, and soft bits of them cling like mucus to caps, oilskin aprons, lashes, lips. Indeed, so much atmosphere is so pungently evoked aboard the Polar Star that on the whole I'd rather spend my time in a Soviet psychiatric hospital. But Arkady just wants to be left alone. He's trapped instead between the KGB and Soviet naval intelligence. He isn't sure whether he's supposed to solve the murder or cover it up. He finds himself in the middle of two conspiracies, one having to do with drug smuggling, the other with underwater espionage, which may or may not be related. Before Arkady ends up being chased across the ice cap of the Northern Wastes, we will have heard a lot of the new rhetoric of the Gorbachev era, learned a lot about Soviet womanhood, gotten on intimate terms with ironies both emotional and political, and decided never again under any circumstances to eat fish. What's more astonishing, an American writer, inside the head of a Soviet policeman, will oblige us powerfully to empathize with Russian patriotism. Every aspect of Polar Star closes and clicks like the hasp of a knife, like the folds of a fan. More than a satisfaction, it's a dazzler.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Martin Cruz Smith's novel, Polar Star. The interviews on Fresh Air are scheduled and produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet a man for whom death is just the beginning, medical examiner Michael Bodden. And on the 20th anniversary of Apollo 11, Stuart Brand explains how he influenced the space program and got himself investigated by the FBI in the process. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. That and more next time on Fresh Air.